Welcome to the Trauma Survivorhood Podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Miley, an IFS-informed certified trauma recovery coach. This show features interviews from survivors all over the world as they share their impactful story of thriving in their post-traumatic growth. We explore resources, tools, and coping skills to support the trauma survivor community. Enjoy. Welcome back to the Trauma Survivorhood Podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Miley. We have with us today Judy Foreman, and Judy is the author of several books, A Nation in Pain, The Global Pain Crisis, Exercise is Medicine, and her recent novel in 2022, CRISPRed, and now more recently, her memoir called Let the More Loving One Be Me. She was a staff writer at the Boston Globe for 23 years and a health columnist for most of those years. Her column was syndicated in outlets including the LA Times and the Dallas Morning News and others. She graduated from Wellesley College in 1966, spent 3 years in the Peace Corps in Brazil, and then got a master's from Harvard, the Graduate School of Education. She's been a lecturer on medicine at Harvard and a fellow there as well. And she was also a senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis. She's won more than 50 journalism awards and most recently the 2015 Science and Society Award from the National Association of Science Writers for her book called A Nation in Pain. Judy, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm really excited to share this space with you. Welcome to the podcast. Just tell us a little bit more. Let's just jump right in and share your story. You are now walking in freedom after trauma. You've accomplished, obviously, a lot in your life. Just how did you land here today?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. I will try to capsulize my story. Yes, I did have a lot of trauma growing up, childhood trauma. As you will find out if you read my memoir, Let the More Loving One Be Me. My father was sexually abusive. He used to come to the bedroom door where I was trying to go to sleep every night, and he was half naked. He only had a T-shirt on. And I grew up in terror that he was going to come all the way in the room and rape me. Mm-hmm. He never actually did. But it was like a mock execution. I never knew when he might come in. So every night I basically was terrified. And it was, you know, it was such a normal thing. It didn't occur to me to tell my mother. She would not have done anything anyway. We were all so scared of my father. No one could stand up to him. Mm-hmm. But I don't think she would have told him or thought, you know, she would not really, she did not, certainly did not protect me. And I don't know how she could not have known he was going down the hall undressed. She was also difficult for me. She was a much nicer person than my father, which that's setting the bar pretty low. But she was nice, gracious, charming, but emotionally unavailable. So I really grew up with nobody attending to me or my brother for that matter. But after I left home, things got better. I went to an all women's college, which was Wellesley, which was wonderful. I was valued as a woman, despite being a woman, because of being a woman. It was really a huge antidote to the way I grew up. And as you said, I went in the Peace Corps with my first husband and we had our child there. He's now 54. It was a long time ago. And after we got back from the Peace Corps, I was on track to get a doctorate in psychology. But a friend of mine suggested that I try becoming a reporter, which I did at the Lowell Sun, which is near where both you and I live. And it was just, you know, an epiphany. This was what I wanted to do. It was really fun. And I went on to the Boston Globe, where I spent most of my career. And it occurs to me sort of in retrospect about my life that I've been engaged in a big search for truth, mm-hmm. both in terms of my family and what was the truth of my family, and as a journalist searching for truth in all the stories I did. And the truth sometimes is multiple. There are different truths, and two people can see the same situation differently. But digging for the actual truth has actually turned out to be my life, and that's been good. I've been very fortunate in having a career that has just been fun and noble and rewarding, and also fortunate in the men I married. My first husband and I got divorced, but it was a very amicable divorce. My second husband died of cancer, and I'm with my third husband now, and it's the best relationship I've ever had. So there is life after trauma, but it does take a lot of work to undo the pain and the hurt and the damage.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it absolutely does. I love the way that you say that, you know, to undo what was done, or in your case also what wasn't done, right? Without the protection of your mother. Yeah. So just, you know, that idea of trauma, it's not just what, you know, happened to you that shouldn't, it's what should have happened to you that didn't. So, you know,
boy, are you right? Yes. Yeah. And in fact, in retrospect and thinking about it all now, that was much more damaging than the trauma itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you know that? How are you so sure of that? Because
lived and learned experience. Lived and learned experience. You know, trauma is defined in a lot of different ways, but it's often the neglectful side of, you know, or the people that tried to shush you from telling your story.
Exactly.
It's that often has a lot more psychological damage because you really can internalize it from there. So
that is so true for me.
Yeah.
My mother shushed me and my brother. She kept saying my father was wonderful. He was not wonderful. Mm-hmm. He was angry, alcoholic, vengeful, authoritarian, unkind, unloving, just not a decent human being.
Yeah. No,
and the shushing of my own feelings has been a lifelong, ongoing effort to correct internally.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah. Thank you for sharing your story and being so open with it. What was the most difficult thing that you'd say in the healing process? What was most difficult for you to overcome?
I'm not sure I have totally overcome it. I think it's still difficult for me to have honest emotions without freaking out that I should not be feeling that way. Mm-hmm. Like particularly sadness is hard for me because my mother was like falsely cheerful, chipper all the time, falsely cheerful. You know, everything was fine. Well, it wasn't fine.
Yeah.
It wasn't fine at all. So being honest and trying to allow myself to feel sad takes an enormous amount of courage for me. It shouldn't, but it does. So that's something I still work on. Mm-hmm. But I'm much better than I used to be.
I want to just dive in before we jump into your memoir. You've written a lot of books in the medical world, right? About the chronic pain, really, I guess, is it called an epidemic, I would suppose?
It is.
What kind of effects does trauma, violence, poverty, things like that have on the national pain crisis?
I didn't study the pain as a result of trauma, but pain itself is very traumatic. Especially because many people, especially women, are often not believed about their pain. Pain is very hard to measure. You can sometimes pick it up on an MRI or some sort of brain scan, but you can't, there's no blood test, there's no X-ray. You know, there's only kind of giving your history of what's wrong and some physical tests, but people are not believed. And they're thought to be hypochondriacs or, you know, making it all up. And that's an extra burden, an extra trauma. And that the medical system adds that trauma to the pain that people already have. It's an epidemic. The last time I looked, which was a while ago, there were an estimated 100 million Americans suffering with chronic pain. Not all of those are incapacitated, but that's a lot of people. And the thing that really bothers me the most about that is, well, one thing, people in chronic pain are twice as likely to commit suicide as people not in pain. The other thing that really bothers me is that all the media attention, except for my book and a few other things, have been on the opioid crisis, which is a definite epidemic and is terrible in its own way. But what that has done is stigmatize pain patients, some of whom really do need opioids to function. It has made it harder to get opioids for them. Doctors are afraid to prescribe opioids. And certainly opioids are not the only way to treat pain. And for some types of pain, they're not the appropriate way to treat pain. But for people who genuinely need them, a lot of those people can't get them. And that makes the pain crisis even worse. Mm-hmm. So my heart goes out to pain patients who need these medications and can't get them. Mm-hmm. And that's because all the attention has been on the downside of opioids, which is huge, absolutely huge. That's a massive problem, but so is chronic pain.
Yeah. For sure. I had a guest last year who was in a train derailment, and she talked to us quite a bit. She's now a speaker on the opioids that people need when they actually have, you know, I mean, she wasn't expected to survive. She was crushed from head to toe. And so she is just on this healing, physical healing journey, and she needed those pain medications, and they would have to go from pharmacy to pharmacy to pharmacy, you know, hunting them down. And people just looked at her like she was an addict, but she was right. Physically in severe pain, debilitated. So yeah, it is, it's wild to think that. So when you were doing your studies, and I know you said you kind of almost got into the psychology world, you know, obviously books, like Bessel's book, The Body Keeps the Score was a big deal. Yes. And we know that trauma gets stuck in the body like that. And I think a lot of people with chronic pain tend to, have trauma in their history. Is that something that you have dealt with yourself, in your history with, you know, finding there's a lot of studies about like GI issues, migraine sufferers, or generally people who've grown up in a lot of trauma?
No, I wouldn't say that I have somatized that or expressed that physically. My shoulders are often tight from anxiety. So in that sense, yes, but actual chronic pain, no, I guess I lucked out on that, but I know that what you're saying is true.
Yeah, it's amazing. What a national crisis. What help do you offer, you know, from that book stance? I haven't read the Nation in Pain book from, that was back in 2014, I believe. You know, what is there an offering of help for people who might be struggling, just to live day to day with chronic pain? What would you give them for some advice?
There's lots of things. Often, depending on the community where you live, there may be pain patient support groups. There's a wonderful one run by a woman named Cindy Steinberg here in Boston. The American Chronic Pain Foundation, I think I've got the name right, has some resources. And there are, you know, there's some less dramatic ways of treating pain that can sometimes help. Acupuncture, massage, psychotherapy to deal with the stress of it. And some medications, you know, NSAIDs and other medications. But basically, treating chronic pain is a nightmare. It's very hard to do successfully. But leaning on other people appropriately can really help. And I know in some of the pain support groups, people find out about, you know, who's a good doctor, who's not. You know, you can get a lot of information as well as emotional support. So that's a good thing to do.
Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. Thank you for that. I'm going to link those up in the show notes, some of the ones that you just mentioned there. I want to jump into your new book, which is a memoir of your life story. This focus is really on healing and thriving, which is where you're at now. Was it difficult to write? Did you find it very, you know, healing? Was it helpful to write it?
Well, I didn't set out to write it, actually. I'm in this program. It's a lifelong learning program. Mm-hmm. And I decided to take a course on memoir writing. I've been a journalist all my life, which is a very different kind of writing. You tell all the facts right up front. It's very objective. You don't talk about yourself. But I thought, okay, I'll take a course in memoir writing. And the first thing that came out of my computer was this story about my father. And his abuse. And I thought, oh, this is really interesting. So I took that course repeatedly for a number of years. And before I knew it, I had a whole stack of memoirs. And I thought, well, I could string these together as a book, including some actual reporting on the prevalence of sexual abuse and the prevalence of alcoholism. And we haven't talked about that, but I think one in five, if I remember correctly, of adult Americans grew up in an alcoholic family. That too is extremely traumatic. Has a lot of, you know, you end up with a lot of psychological problems from that kind of family as well. So the book has some reportage in it to help people deal with those situations or to let people know about those situations. And then, you know, the book talks about, you know, the wonderful, fun career I had as a journalist. I still have, actually, in a way, as a journalist, and some of my escapades in that world. And also it talks about therapy has been incredibly helpful for me. I highly recommend it. And, you know, I've been very lucky, and it's thanks in part to therapy, to have been able to gravitate toward really good men, which is good, because a lot of people growing up in my situation might have married abusers or alcoholics or, you know, otherwise not terrific men.
Yeah, the statistics there would be the abuse cycle for sure. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
When you find that, I want to.
Can I just add to that? I don't know if abusers ever get better. I do know that alcoholics who are in recovery can be wonderful partners for people. So I didn't want to, be pejorative toward people who have dealt with their alcoholism and are still dealing with their alcoholism.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we know from trauma that most abusers were probably abused themselves, right? So if they are willing to do that deep, deep work of trauma recovery for themselves, they might be able to turn some of those coping skills, which is that lashing out and the abusive behavior, they might be able to turn that around. But, you know, alcoholism, there's a lot of great, you know, AA and, you know, just getting into recovery. Those are great options, you know, for alcoholics. I do find it interesting when you talk about not going into those kind of relationships. Did you struggle at any point with like your self-worth, like thinking that you were going to go into relationships like that, where you needed to be around people who were just, degrading who you were, if you will?
Not really. I think I always had pretty decent men. I do remember, but long ago, kind of being attracted to exciting men as opposed to reliable men. My first husband was less organized than I was. He wasn't abusive or anything, but life was very exciting because I never knew what was going to happen. But he was a very nice, kind person. We're both immature, though. That's why that one didn't work. But I remember having a discussion with my therapist, like, I really like exciting men. And she said, what about reliable men? You know, oh, okay. And reliable is great.
For sure.
Reliable is great.
Yeah. You know, changing relationships inside of therapeutic relationships, you know, recognizing, you know, this isn't for me, or this is something I want more. It's just because you're learning more about yourself, right? So the deeper you go, the more you're going to figure out what it is you don't want and what you actually do want. Yeah.
Absolutely. And recognizing, I went out with some guys who really just weren't available emotionally. They could talk about computers and cars and God knows what else, but not really available emotionally. And as I began to value that, then I picked men who were more and more available emotionally.
Yeah.
Which was great.
Yeah. Well, great. And you mentioned that your mom wasn't super emotionally available to you.
No, absolutely not. Yeah. And as we were talking before, that was the deeper damage, for lack of a better word, the deeper trauma. Trauma is a good word for that.
Yeah.
Because growing up, you know, in terms of attachment, you really need someone you can trust. And if there's no one there, what do you do? Mm. In my case, I became a goody two shoes and studied and did all the right things. And but that doesn't replace what's missing. Mm. Yeah. Lets you cope, but it doesn't replace what's missing.
Yeah.
So I think we're very wise to highlight that.
Yeah, that's very true. I resonate with that for sure. So tell us, this new book, who is it for? Who is it written for? Who should be picking up this book?
Well, I think I sort of wrote it for fun, actually. I was enjoying writing his memoirs. I think, I essentially wrote it for myself. But there's also sort of, I have a kind of an inner sense that this would resonate, and in fact, seems to be resonating with a lot of people who have had any kind of trauma. I mean, I had one guy live in an apartment building, and one guy read it, and certainly he was not a woman who had been abused. I mean, he wasn't in that situation at all. And he read the book, and it resonated with him because his father had said, when he was on his deathbed, he told this son of his, "You'll never amount to anything." And this guy is, God knows how many years later, traumatized by that. So lots of people have trauma. They have a suicide in their family, or someone who's very sick or unavailable, or, sexual abuse and alcoholism are not the only ways people can end up traumatized. The death of a parent or a sibling. All those things can create trauma that you have to do the hard work of healing. And it is hard work.
Yeah.
But it's worth it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Thank you for that. I've loved our conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today. I always like to ask all of my guests, so in your personal healing, obviously now people can go pick up this memoir as a resource and a way that they can, emotionally connect with someone who's been through similar things. But while you were healing, you've already mentioned therapy, but beyond that, what were some really helpful, very catalyst ways and resources and tools that you had in your healing journey?
I think realizing how common the problem is, talking to people and realizing a lot of people have been through the same thing, the sense that you are not alone with this stuff is really helpful. Exercise has been, as you know, because I wrote a book about the medical benefits of exercise. I mean, that's been huge too. And also doing things that gratify you. I'm in a singing group and I'm on a swim team, and doing things that sort of nurture your own life. That really matters too.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. Thank you. So you touched on your book, the Exercise is Medicine. Can we jump there just for a second before I let you go? Sure. Can you just give us just a quick background of the science there of how exercise is so helpful? This would be for chronic pain. This is also for mental health medicine as well. So can you just kind of tell us the science background?
Not in a nutshell, but...
Exercise. I put you on the spot. This wasn't one of the planned questions. Indulge us.
Exercise is probably the most useful thing you can do to avoid aging any faster than necessary. There are, I think, I forget now, 12 or 13 specific biological milestones or hallmarks of aging. They're very, very minute, molecules. And exercise seems to help slow down all of these processes that are involved with aging. It's almost like a magic bullet for aging. A lot of people don't do it, but they definitely should. Mm-hmm. And my book, I love that book because it motivates me every time I reread it. Exercise is very powerful. And as you mentioned, for mental health too, when we exercise, our brain actually pumps out a chemical that people have nicknamed Miracle Grow for the brain. Its real name is sort of a mouthful. It's BDNF, which stands for brain-derived neurotrophic factor. But you can think of it just as Miracle Grow. And this chemical that the brain makes during exercise makes nerve cells grow in the brain in the memory center called the hippocampus. And it also works with other chemicals in the brain to combat depression. And in fact, in a lot of studies, aerobic exercise can be as effective as some of the antidepressant medications. So it's exercise is very, very powerful. And people should do it. There's an obesity epidemic, a chronic pain epidemic, and exercise can be very helpful in combating all of those.
Yeah. For both. So even just getting outside, taking a half an hour walk out in nature, is that enough? If someone's just starting out, is that helpful in itself?
Yes. Walking 30 minutes a day can really help.
Yeah.
And can be enjoyable. And if you don't want to do it by yourself, what helps a lot of people is to sign up, commit with a friend to doing it. Then you're not going to leave that person standing on the sidewalk while you change your mind.
Yeah.
Sort of makes you do it, which is a good thing.
Excellent. Yes, that's so true. It's like an accountability partner every day.
Exactly. Even
a couple of times a week, getting out, that's shown really marked changes in mental health for people all over the world. I mean, the studies are out there. Anyone can look those up. But I appreciate you kind of breaking that down just so that, you know, people could be reminded this is a really, really helpful tool. And it's free if you just put on some shoes and go outside and walk. Some people want gym memberships. Some people want to, you know, take swimming lessons. Some people want to go on really, really expensive, you know, join tennis clubs and do things like that. But all you have to do is put on some shoes and get outside and you can really clear up that head. So
that's right.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Well, thank you so much for being here. Before I let you go, please tell us where we can find you, where we can find the book, plug your website. And I'll put all of this below in the show notes for everyone to click on.
Okay. Well, the book is called Let the More Loving One Be Me. You can find it on Amazon. You can look for it by the title or by my name, which is Judy Foreman. And you have to spell it right, which is Foreman. You can also go to my website, which is judyforeman.com, and get the book there. And you can also see some interviews on YouTube if you search for me. I'm easy to find.
Yay. Excellent. I will have that linked up for our viewers and our listeners below. Judy, thank you so much for sharing your space with us here today. Have a good one. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to or watching this episode of the Trauma Survivorhood Podcast. Please subscribe, like, share, and follow. For any information that was discussed in this podcast episode, check out the show notes below. Until next time, be well.